So we're not just tackling hunger, we're really tackling food waste. You know, more than a third of all the food produced globally goes to waste. It's the third largest contributor to climate change. It's like a catastrophe, every which way you look at it. I think the potential is massive.
If you run a business and are looking for space, we're talking two of you needing a couple of desks to hundreds of you needing a stunning new office. You need to check out Hubble HQ. They have a beautiful, easy-to-use website where you can find just what you're looking for. And you can book and manage your office viewings through the click of a button. You'll also get a dedicated expert advisor who can help you make the right decision and negotiate the best deal for you. Best thing? These guys won't bore you with jargon. They'll just sort you out. And I should know, I'm a happy customer. Whether your thing is stunning views or fridges full of free booze, you'll find it on Hubble HQ. So go to hubblehq.com/secret leaders to find your perfect office today.
Right, we're going to get into some quick fire questions, if that's okay with you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so summer or winter?
Definitely summer.
Okay, office or work from home?
Work from home, for sure.
Okay, tube or taxi?
Oh, bike, but then tube, then taxi, Uber.
Okay, and USA or England?
England.
Why?
I've been here for 13 years and it just really feels like home. I'm from Iowa originally, which is where my lovely family is, but it's not a place I personally would want to move back to. And so otherwise I feel a bit homeless in the U.S., whereas London really feels like a home. I have a great group of friends and I have my child here. So definitely the U.K.
Okay. Takeaway or home cooking?
Home cooking.
And red wine or white wine?
Red wine.
And finally, a beach holiday or a snow holiday?
I know it's cheating, but I do like to do both each year. But if I had to choose, I would probably choose a beach holiday.
Okay. Good. Right. I'm glad you actually chose, because a lot of guests just sit on the fence. And it's like, there are harder questions in life than picking one of those two.
That's true.
Okay. So thank you, firstly, for letting me delve deeper into your story. So firstly, you made the jump from banker to the app Olio. What made you turn your back on, I guess, a successful career in banking? Or can you just take us quickly through your original journey in finance, I guess, more broadly?
Yes. So my philosophy when I graduated from university was to build a really bulletproof CV and to sort of de-risk my professional career so that if anything ever happened, I knew that I could get a great job and support myself. I was really seeking financial security and career stability. So I went and worked at Morgan Stanley for 4 years. I then went, I was in a variety of banking roles as an analyst. It was, God, 20 years ago now, so it's a distant memory. And then, as one does, I went to business school where I actually met my Olio co-founder 15 years ago. We met at Stanford, and I spent 2 years trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life and just failed at coming up with anything. Really, in hindsight, I was just very, very risk averse. I think I knew what I wanted to do. I'd written about it in my business school applications. I'd written about wanting to have a startup in food, actually, but I was just very risk averse. So I went and worked at McKinsey for a few years, which was an excellent training ground, but certainly not a place I wanted to spend the rest of my life or career. Yeah, so after McKinsey, I spent 6 years at American Express, which was a much more balanced lifestyle, which is something I've been craving after banking and consulting. But it's still a huge global organization, and making change was really difficult. And I found that very frustrating. And at times I felt like, you know, what's sort of the point? I'm just going through the motions. You know, I'm on a high potential career path, but I don't actually see anything around me changing. And I had the very, very good fortune of being able to opt for redundancy when I was on maternity leave. I had been given a promotion in my absence, and the promotion required more travel, significantly more travel. And at that time, I had a newborn, and, you know, I'm an expat. I don't have family here. I could not get my head around how I was going to make that work. And it was such a relief to be able to have grounds upon which to turn down that offer and to take a very, very generous redundancy package. So I did the maths, and I figured out if I cut my spending in half, I could live for about 4 years off of that package. And that was probably one of the best days of my life. Just instant felt this, like, all the sort of financial security that I'd been seeking, the freedom to think about what I really wanted to do, all came at once, not to mention the joy of being a new mother. So it was a really good time period. And before I actually started Olio, I started a different business called My Crush in North London. That was born out of my personal experience on maternity leave when I recognized a gap in the market for flexible childcare. I was desperate just for a few hours to myself. And I ended up spending a lot of time at the Virgin Gym, where there was a creche. And you could check your child in for 2 hours, but you couldn't leave the premise. And I noticed that a lot of moms were checking their children in and sort of reading a magazine or catching up on email. So I had the idea to open a high street creche where mothers and fathers could drop their children off on a pay-as-you-go basis.
So, okay, but let's just take it back to during your redundancy period of this 4-year magical area. How many years into this had you decided to build my creche?
About a month.
Oh, okay. Right. Okay. So, all that freedom.
Yes, it didn't last very long. I'm definitely...
From freedom to the most responsibility you could possibly give yourself.
I'm a doer. I'm very, I have a lot of energy. I love getting my hands dirty. I can remember my son being about 4 days old and him strapped in a sling around my, around my chest, mowing the lawn. Like, I just am a sort of get up and do project kind of person. I loved the feedback that we got from parents and knowing that we were really providing a valuable service to those customers. But scaling was a very difficult thing. And because of the way childcare is priced and the way it's regulated, the profit that you can get from it is capped. So it's around that time that I decided I wasn't going to open more creches, that Tessa, my co-founder from Olio, and I came together and started actively looking for an environmental challenge that we could tackle at scale. At that time, my father, who's very eccentric and I love working with, decided to run for U.S. Senator in Iowa, and I went back to Iowa to spend 2 months as his campaign manager. It was a wonderful opportunity to actually work alongside my dad. Obviously, we've holidayed and we've shared our life stories, but working really hard on something over an 8-10 week period was just provided a whole different level of interaction that I cherish and I'm glad that I got to experience. Needless to say, he did not win at all. But I'm very proud of him for trying. And at the end of that, that would have been November 2014, that's when Tess and I came together again. And she was on her second maternity leave, and I had to decide what I wanted to do next. And I knew I wanted to do something entrepreneurial, and we'd worked together in the past. And we did a very sort of consulting MBA type of thing to do, where we did a big market study looking for an idea. And we knew we wanted to do something that would benefit the environment. We knew we wanted to work in an area that could be disrupted with technology and that was highly scalable and global, et cetera, as one does. And we spent about 3 months actively interviewing, CEOs of recycling plants and CEOs of plastic manufacturers and trying to understand if there was an opportunity to build sort of a global B2B marketplace for different waste streams. And we couldn't find anything. In fact, it was incredibly frustrating. And we got to the point, I remember very clearly, on January 23rd, 2015, when and there was a third friend working with us on this, and we had to sort of look at ourselves and we're like, there is nothing here that we can do. Nothing here that's exciting. And we were in tears. So we called it quits on the project. And that's when I was about probably to open a bottle of red wine.
Did the project have a code name?
I can't remember, to be honest. I probably did.
Code name, red wine. code name, don't get to the red wine.
Well, we were with my friend Maria. She likes champagne, and Tessa's more of a white wine girl. So, but Tessa went upstairs to put her child down, and she came back downstairs, and she said, there was this one thing that happened to me that I haven't told you about yet. And she went on to describe how the month earlier, when she'd been moving back from Geneva to the UK, on moving day, she found herself with food that she wasn't going to be able to eat in time, including some organic, non-perishable, not fruit specifically. It was sweet potatoes and cabbages, if I remember correctly. And the removal men said she wasn't going to be able to take them with her. And she was not going to let them sit in the corporate flat and go to waste. So she bundled up her two kids in the middle of winter and went out on the street trying to find someone to give them to. And she couldn't. And she got very frustrated and over-emotional.
Because she looked like a crazy lady carrying some sweet
potatoes. Take my cabbages and potatoes.
Yeah, exactly.
And she knew if she'd knocked on her neighbor's door, she'd probably be able to find someone. But that was an awkward thing for an English woman to do, and she wasn't going to do it. And as she described this experience and her sort of frustration that there wasn't a solution, we really did have that joint aha moment. I think Tessa, it had been fermenting in her back, in the back of her head for a while. But for me, as soon as she told me, I was like, that's just ridiculous. There's an app for everything. There should be a platform that connects people with food that they don't want with people nearby that want that. And within the hour, we named the company. Within the hour, we'd agreed we were both going to put in $20,000 to bootstrap the company and give ourselves 1 year to get traction and momentum and defer going back to the workforce for a year.
And for that $20,000, did you include your own salaries or were you just like, we'll work on this for free in the meantime? We were $20,000 is purely on the business.
I still had my redundancy packaged and Tessa was on maternity leave.
Yeah, cool.
So no salaries, just to build the app. We had to move very quickly. We're both the primary breadwinners in our family. We've got young children. We don't have time to waste. So what we did is we ended up finding an agency in Bristol named Simple Web, who are fantastic, who took a small equity stake in exchange for 50% off the MVP build of the app, which meant that we were out of pocket 25 of our 40. Mm. But before we did that, even though we were absolutely convinced we had to bring this to life, we had a lot of people who were skeptical, and specifically our partners who just were like, what are you talking about? People are not going to go walking around meeting their neighbors picking up moldy carrots. That's what Tessa's partner kept saying.
I mean, it's better when they're not moldy.
Yes,
I know. As a customer of yours, I haven't given anyone moldy anything yet.
No, I know. But so what we did is we first did a market research, just a Survey Monkey. We got as many people locally to fill it out to let us know, obviously, you know, how they felt about food waste. And we learned that 1 in 3 people feel, quote unquote, physically pained when they throw away food that is edible or was recently edible. We found that 90-95% of people would be willing to walk up to 10 minutes to pick up homegrown fruit and veg from a neighbor. And we got lots of interesting insights. And that was reassuring. We then identified 12 people who were very excited about Oleo and didn't know each other, but all lived within a 15-minute walk of each other. And we asked them to participate in a real MVP. And we put them in a WhatsApp group for 2 weeks. And the rules were very simple. Add any food that you don't want or you're not going to eat. Private message to request it if you do. And I think it was a matter of minutes before when we said, okay, everyone, you're in the group, go live. And we sort of sat there. And it was within minutes someone added a bag of shallots. And right away, 2 people responded, I'll take them. And it was just I think we cried. I'm sure we cried because it just happened and it worked and it was seamless. And over the course of those 2 weeks, there were 26 collections between those 12 neighbors. And when we debriefed with the different the participants, they all said, this is amazing. And I've been talking to this guy on Twitter for 5 years and he lives around the corner from me. I didn't even know it. And now we've had tea. And we also learned that whatever we built didn't need to be that much better than a WhatsApp group. So a lot of the things we thought we needed in the beginning, like user profiles and ratings, and people like, no, like just very simple. And that helped us, from a features perspective, really scale back on what we launched originally. When we launched on July 9th, we had collected physically 2,200 email addresses. So between the Easter WhatsApp group and the July launch, we were out on the streets every single day. We hand-delivered over 10,000 letters through people's neighbor letterboxes, directing them to a website where they could pre-register. We stood on the street corner handing out food that we picked up from shops that they were about to throw away at the end of the day, saying, look at this food. It was going to be thrown away. If you think it's crazy, sign up, pre-register. And when people did pre-register, they basically gave us their email address. We would ask them on a scale of 1 to 10, how excited are you about this? And if they said 9 or 10, we said, you've got to volunteer. Like, we need your help. We can't do it without you. So we had 30 volunteers on day one. And those were our little market makers. And we dispatched them to help clear, quote unquote, the marketplace when someone who wasn't a volunteer was, let's say, adding something and it wasn't getting requested. So it was a very, very manual grassroots process in the beginning. And that's still how we launch in new areas today.
In fact, I was at my gym the other day and I sent you a photo and you were like, no, that would have been a volunteer that put those there.
Yep.
It was amazing to see that happen. I mean, that must be one of the coolest things about your brand, to have a brand that people are passionate enough to just go and do that for is basically the dream.
It is. It's fantastic. We've had 25,000 people volunteer And we basically give them a hyperlocal marketing kit and a community, and we cheerlead, and we enable them to create an Olio network in their neighborhood.
And how does the Olio network run? Is that on Facebook? Is that through the app?
The volunteer network, we have a closed volunteer group on Facebook. Eventually, we will be migrating it in to the app or a volunteer portal. We're sort of looking at that now, but it's been good enough on a closed volunteer Facebook group. But we also have a volunteer portal where volunteers can access sort of all the information and guides and inspiration that they would need, order marketing materials. We have lots of different flyers and posters and letters. So it's really a self-service approach and a bit of an open source approach as well.
Hey team, if you, like me, are interested in neuroscience, psychology, and nutrition for the brain to keep at your peak mental condition like our secret leaders, then you'll love my new startup, Dawn. We send a 3-minute summary every Sunday in your inbox, or you can find us on Instagram at @WeAreDawn, where we post one science-backed thing to improve your mind every day. Check us out at www.trydawn.co. And before you leave this podcast episode, don't forget to hit subscribe. Thanks.
And, you know, fast forward now to 2019. How many downloads have you had? How many active users, active Olioers, if that is a word, if there's a word with more vowels in it, then I'd like to know. But
we do use Olioing and Olioers. We do use that a lot.
You mean I'm not coming up with something new?
2019 will certainly be at 1 million downloads and 800,000 signed up users in over 160 countries. We've seen food sharing take place successfully in 49 countries due to the grassroots volunteer model, which means we have micro communities all over the place. And because it's user generated content, people are able to hack it in different geographies, and it works well enough. We will be at 1.5 million portions of food that have been successfully shared between neighbors. There's certainly a lot of momentum, especially considering that we've spent less than 5% of our budget on marketing. And so it's really been an organic growth model through word of mouth, through the volunteering activities, through partnerships, through press.
I think the one thing that surprises me, if I may, about your strategy, knowing that you're very intelligent and think things through. That's not based just on this conversation. For listeners, I'm not that biased. but is that you would want to be in 160 countries so soon when the brilliance of what got you going. I mean, basically, as you all know, having done it, building a marketplace is just insanely complicated. And very few companies have done it brilliantly in any industry. And one of the key rules they usually have is don't grow too fast, too broadly, etc. Because it is a supply and demand market. And when you're in a country where one of those is lopsided, there's no product.
Yes. So I'm definitely not trying to say that we have active functioning marketplaces in 160 countries. We originally had that mindset as well. We were very strict and constrained growth to certain geographic areas. And if you weren't within that geographic circle, originally it was just sort of 6 square miles when we did our pilot in North London, and then we went to Hackney and North London, and then we went to M25, et cetera. But we had so many people reaching out from outside of those areas saying, I understand it's going to be a poor experience. I understand that there might not be liquidity in my neighborhood yet, but I'm willing to volunteer to take the initiative to make that happen. And it turns out you only need about 50 people all within the little, one little neighborhood signed up, and one individual volunteer can build that out themselves. So we're half a decade or a decade away from having active marketplaces in every country like Airbnb does or something like that. And obviously that is the aspiration. But in the short term, we've decided that if there are keen and eager people out there who want to start stopping food waste now, start connecting their community, let's empower them to do that.
So I guess the key part of your strategy, if anything, is to find the right kind of volunteers. Do you have like a vetting process? Is that something you've spent more time in that area than most of the other ones?
We do spend a lot of time thinking about our volunteers and how to inspire them. And we actually have 4 different types of volunteers, and there's a bit of a hierarchy and increased responsibility and status that come with the different types of volunteers. So we have food waste heroes who are working on the supply side of the marketplace. We have about 3,000 of those right now. And that's a thorough vetting process. They have to do a kitchen self-assessment. They have to do online training for food health and safety. They have to have a phone call with a team member before they can start collecting food. So these volunteers, these food waste heroes, are matched with businesses that have unsold food at the end of the day, food they haven't been able to sell, they haven't been able to discount, they haven't been able to donate to charity because there's just not enough charities, and charities can't take all the types of food. There's still food that is fit for human consumption that could benefit the local community. And so those volunteers take that food and they bring it straight home, put it in their fridge, add it to the app, and within an hour or two, their neighbors come around to their house to collect it. So that's because it's food safety, and food safety is incredibly important, and the businesses that donate to us need to know that we are taking it seriously. It's a very sort of strong vetting process for those volunteers. For the ambassadors, which are sort of our volunteers that are building demand, it's not so much of a vetting process, because if you want to hand out flyers on our behalf and put up posters, you know what, we're probably going to let you. That's more about keeping them engaged over the long term. So how do we, after the initial rush of, okay, I put up all the flyers, I put up all the posters, now what do? We need to sort of keep them in a proactive mindset over the course of a year or longer.
So shout out to the listeners that want to become Olio supporters and volunteers. What have they got to do?
Go to the volunteering section. Actually, I think it's called Get Involved on our website, and all of the information is there.
Super. That'll do. And maybe even tweet you on Twitter?
Yeah, you can tweet us, Facebook us, Instagram us. We cannot do what we have done to date without our volunteers. And volunteering is really fun. It feels good to stop food from going to waste. It feels good to connect people to share food. Mm.
And from a lady that spent too much time in Britain, obviously, and lost any sense of her Americanism, where is the tweet me right now at this address, do this, do that? This is what I kind of expect from, you know, the American gusto. Come on, like, let's tell people what to do.
At @Olio_EX. I won't go into why you don't want to go to OlioEX. Oh. Please don't go and look there.
I really want to know.
No, it's not a very nice Twitter handle.
Is it not child friendly?
No, it's okay. Not.
It's not your old listeners. Crash company.
No. @Olio_EX. Okay. Olio, the food sharing revolution. I mean, if you type in Olio in food, you will find us.
Why Olio?
Olio is a synonym for hodgepodge. So it's a miscellaneous assortment of things. But Tess and I really liked the symmetry, and the O's are very symbolic in terms of circular economy, the earth. It wasn't an over-considered decision. It took us less than an hour. But as soon as we came across Olio, we were like, done. Okay. We should have probably checked that it means olive oil in Italian, but...
But never mind.
Never mind.
There's nothing wrong with olive oil.
It's also something aspirational. It sounds like appetizing. It's not the Food Waste Recovery Network or something that's perhaps not very modern.
That is true. Right. I think it's time to take a step back to your sordid past. No, I'm joking. It's not sordid. Okay. So, well, semi. It's. I wouldn't say sordid, just different. So you do have a very unusual childhood. So for starters, real birth name, Sasha Celestial One.
Correct.
Take us through what kind of fucking weird hippie shit that is. So our British listeners, and even, I mean, 50% of our listeners are American, even they're going to find this weird. So talk to us about this.
Sure. So my mother's name is Sun, which she changed her name to when I was younger. And my dad is Richard Stewart. And they...
Richard, that great constellation.
They met at a health food store that they were both supporting. That was one of the first health food stores sort of in my town. And it wasn't long after that I was born. And they were entrepreneurs. They founded a company called Frontier Cooperative Herbs, which for the first decade of my life was unsensational, to say the least.
That's herbs for British listeners.
Yes, yeah. Herbs, yes, and spices and natural products. And they were sort of one of the very, very few, at the heart of one of the very few hippie communities in the Midwest, which is sort of a meat and potatoes type of place, lots of farming, et cetera, very traditional. And I mean, I guess that you name the hippie stereotype. I sort of experienced it. So I was born in a cabin. My mom and my aunt were midwives. And I've witnessed and actually assisted loads of births and actually delivered my two younger sisters when I was in my early teens. You know, none of us were vaccinated, raised on a very vegan-ish, mostly diet. We all have different surnames. I went to Grateful Dead concerts every single summer until I was old enough to stop going, which would have been 13, which also is when they kept touring beyond that.
Did you pay for the tickets in cash or corn?
I didn't pay for anything. My parents had friends who had a pizza truck that they would drive around all summer on the tour sort of path and sell pizza out of the back of the truck. And we'd just camp and God knows what else. So sort of I grew up with like a pack of, one of my, you know, girlfriends was named Emily Flower Garden, and I don't know. It was a very sort of free-spirited upbringing. It was also very resource-constrained. I don't really like using the word poor, but money was scarce. And so I have a lot of vivid memories of following my mom around town, as you mentioned in the intro, skip diving, for example, collecting plants that were broken behind plant nurseries and then repotting them and selling them on. We sort of had a year-round garage sale. I can remember at one point there being four or five toilets on my front lawn and just being so mortified that I had to come home after school to this. But they'd been rescued from houses that were being torn down, and obviously they had value and my mom wasn't going to let them go to waste. And that type of scavenger mentality is just really instilled in me. And it's, you know, it's something that you can't really escape when you grow up with it. So I'm the type of person who walks down the street in London and sees, you know, a discarded pair of jeans and takes them home and washes them and either gives them to charity or gives them to, wears them myself or gives them to a family member. I can't stand waste of any kind.
I love this story because it is the most unique and unusual upbringing that we have of any of our guests here. But can you take us through your teens? Like, you know, you like obviously growing up, you know, one flower garden and celestial yeah. one together on against a farm. But then, you know, it comes to time where you're like, I want to become a banker. I want to leave this life and I want to go as far away from this kind of, you know, it's just so fascinating psychologically how that can happen. That's such a shift.
Well, you know what? It actually happened. It happened when I was 13 and when I decided to go to boarding school, which was a bit of a fluke. It's hard to explain in one podcast, but yeah, I had a bit of everything in my childhood. And the first sort of part of my childhood was different than my teenage years. And a lot of it has to do with the way my parents separated and the way when they separated, my dad took control of the company that they'd founded for a variety of reasons. And then there was a very big income inequality in my own family. And so my dad could afford and very much wanted his eldest child to escape and to have the best possible education. And he worked really, really, really hard to make that an opportunity for me. And I was, I wouldn't say I was shipped off because I chose to go to Andover, which is one of the best boarding schools sort of in the world, much to my mother's, you know, she was not a fan of that idea at all. Luckily, I was only there for 3 years because I did end up getting expelled, actually, at the end of my junior year.
Why?
I was caught off campus at a party.
Okay.
Twice.
And you're not allowed to do that?
No.
Okay.
Definitely not understood. Allowed to do that. Liability and all of that. And then I ended up not graduating from high school, actually. That was the beginning of what I might call the really wild sort of years.
Yeah. Sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted to tell you guys about the team I use for hiring tech talent, the amazing LaFosse Associates. They're specialists at finding the best people in technology, digital, and change management, and they have an incredible program that takes leadership teams through pre- and post-funding recruitment and scaling headaches. I know you know what I'm talking about. So if you're looking to scale a tech team, you need LaFosse.com. Now back to today's secret leader.
Back to today, then. So you've had this upbringing, you've had this career in banking. Did you, every single interview you ever went to, I have to ask, I know you're probably bored stiff of answering this, but did you always have to explain the Celestial One part? Like Morgan Stanley, were they like,
always.
What?
Always, yeah. Always, yeah, definitely. I mean, in America, they ask you usually within 10 seconds, but it is amazing sometimes here in the UK how long people will wait. Often in an interview here, no, you don't get asked.
You can never not hear such a Celestial One, and I guess it's 100% unique. Yeah. You ever typed your name into Facebook and seen if there's anyone else in the world like you?
Not Facebook. I have Googled it once or twice. I haven't seen with anyone else with the same name.
Okay. I mean, it is depressing how common Daniel Murray is. So anyway. Right. So let's come back to wrapping up towards the end of the interview. I guess some key questions I have for you. What is the actual ambition for Olio? So you don't seem like the type to not have a plan. What is the 5-year plan? What is the 10-year plan? What do your numbers look like? Where are you going?
We just closed our Series A a few months ago.
You know, how much you raised from who?
Yep. So we just raised, we've raised $8 million in total. And Accel and Octopus have been our lead investors. We also have a variety of impact investors, the Norskin Foundation, Quadia, which is based out of Geneva, investors who are, you know, looking for commercial and social returns at the same time, and some fantastic angel investors. We are using that to, we've really grown the team. We're just about 20 people now and are gearing up for scaling. Much of what we've done, especially all of the volunteer management and the surplus food business donations, which is, I should say, the first way that we've become revenue generating because it's a service for which the businesses pay us to organize the volunteers to take the food away. A lot of that has been done manually, all through WhatsApp groups, basically. And it's just at way at breaking point. So the next 6 months are all about gearing up for scaling and then taking a lot of the money we've raised and investing that into, you know, growing through our more scalable machine. We have a huge vision, like absolutely huge. There's no reason that there shouldn't be a food sharing community. And also people can use it. We don't talk about it a lot, but you can use it to share anything. So household products, clothes, books, whatever. Eventually, who knows what else people might be sharing on it. All legal, of course. I didn't know where, that's not where I was going.
So, definitely not where my mind was going, either, I promise.
I mean, we're moving from a resource abundant world to a resource constrained world. And this is becoming increasingly apparent. And giving things that are already in existence or that we've already invested resources and energy into producing an opportunity to extract the maximum value from those things with that food is just going to become a necessity. And so every community around the world, millions of them, should be able to have a tool that facilitates the efficient redistribution of value. And we want to get to 1 billion users. We've said 2025. It might be a bit ambitious, so maybe give it a few more years. But I know that our investors believe that we have that opportunity. It's a really, really scalable platform.
I mean, I actually fully back that and believe it. As you know, first time I used Olio, I was amazed because I took a picture of the most random shit I had in my cupboard. Like it was, I mean, easy vegan egg mix, which is gross, which is why I was giving it away. I just hated it. I was like, I'm never going to finish this. It was a picture of like 9 random things. Someone came and picked it up within 10 minutes. I had so many offers. And what was really cool was I didn't have to take individual pictures of everything. I was just like, here's a bunch of stuff. Here's one photo. Everyone wanted it.
You can imagine how, I mean, the product to date was built with 3 people and just cannot wait to see the full vision of the product come. You know, it should be as easy as like one tap, someone arrives at your door.
Yeah.
Demand is insatiable. Globally, no matter where you are, 50% of listings are on and off the app in under 2 hours. In a place like London, it's like you say, it's 10, 20 minutes. Yeah. There's, you know, 1 in 9 people go to bed hungry every single day. And most of them have a smartphone. And most of them have a roof over their head. And can understand how to use an app like Olio. So we're not just tackling hunger, we're really tackling food waste. You know, more than a third of all the food produced globally goes to waste. It's the third largest contributor to climate change. It's like a catastrophe, every which way you look at it. I think the potential is massive.
Your biggest competitor is the freezer. You ever thought about that?
We often say our biggest competitor is the bin.
Okay, fine. But the second biggest evil is the freezer.
Yes, I don't know how vegan easy eggs would freeze, but
no, true. Well, I mean, they sure as hell didn't taste good either. So, anyway, before we do leave, I have to ask, what is the best piece of advice you've ever been given on your meandering journey? Is it don't throw that away?
I'm not going to be able to recreate the actual words, but a belief that was instilled in me very early is that the only type of failure that counts is not trying at all. And it's better to try, no matter how small, and fail, than to never have the courage to get started. And I think that's just really informed my work ethic and my confidence and redefines what success is. Success is getting out there and doing something. And so I would encourage any budding entrepreneur to come up with whatever is the smallest step that they know they can take with confidence and just to do that and know that that is already better than not doing anything at all. There's also a quote that I love, which is, "Comparison is the thief of joy." And I spent a long part of my life earlier, not when I was less wise, comparing myself to others. And that was the most useless and least productive use of time. And it really just is so counterproductive. So I try not to spend time comparing myself. I try to just recognize that I'm responsible for my own happiness. No one else is. And get out there and get busy.
And have there been any really crucial lessons that you've learned from the dark, more complicated moments? I mean, again, building a marketplace, nightmare. Very difficult.
Hyperlocal marketplace for perishable foods of low transaction value.
Yeah, that is a tongue twister of nightmares.
Luckily, people eat three times a day, so it's a frequent use case.
Okay. Has there been any really amazing lessons you've learned about yourself that you can share with others from getting out of like really uncomfortable, difficult situations in your experience?
I think, and I have had some really tough personal times over the last couple of years, which for me have felt so distracting, like that part of my emotional and mental processing power has been completely sidetracked. Like for one thing I'm comfortable sharing is, you know, I spent a long time trying to conceive a second child without success. And that was, you know, really emotionally traumatic for me. And then that preoccupied a lot of my time and energy. And I felt guilty. I felt like I was letting down my team. I was letting down my co-founder. I was letting down the members of the Olio community. And the internal monologue that you have, you know, you are your own harshest critic. Once I got through sort of some of those periods where I was, you know, I felt preoccupied with my personal life and I checked in with my team and my co-founder, everyone's like, what are you talking about? You know, I almost overcompensated. And so I guess what I would say is that even when you don't feel like you're doing your best, oftentimes it's precisely in those moments that you are doing your best. And you shouldn't give yourself a hard time or beat yourself up for everyone goes through periods of vulnerability and sadness. And that doesn't mean that you're not a good person or not a good entrepreneur.
Okay. So look, finally, as I do have to let you go, but I'm running out of time because I keep wanting to hear more. What other businesses do you think should exist in the world, in the sustainable global circular economy that other people, our listeners, can go out and start thinking about joining a revolution today? What kind of things do you think the world needs?
I mean, I really think that we're going to move towards a shared ownership model for just about everything. More like library of things. And that's actually a concept. But we don't want to own cars. We don't want to own, you know, eventually clothing and iPhones and, you know, everything. We should be leasing it or renting it or, you know, having it for a period of time and then returning it so that it can be repaired and upgraded. I mean, the scale of e-waste that is happening on the planet right now is insane. So why we have any direct primary purchasing going on at all, I do not know. And so I think we need to move really quickly across all classes of of things and stuff to a shared ownership models. That's where I think the future is.
Couldn't agree more. Sasha, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next week on Secret Leaders.
He thinks that I said it was a terrible idea. Quite often I find my default is to try and pick holes in things and to challenge people. What I do remember thinking is I would use this. I knew that Brent would use it, so he had some 1.5 customers at the very least. And that is pretty much my starting point.
That was Baroness Martha Lane Fox, the co-founder of LastMinute.com and karaoke chain Lucky Voice. She's also a pioneer of the UK startup culture in general. She reflects on the horrific, life-changing injury that crippled her and how it changed her perspective, attitude, and life for the better in next week's episode, so tune in or you'll miss out. We hope you enjoyed this episode. It was brought to you by your host, that's me, Dan Murray-Serta, producer, Rich Martel, edited by Harry Morton of Lower Street Media, and if you've heard this, it'll probably have something to do with Jennifer Osman in Canada. You'll also notice throughout this series, we've got some beautiful illustrations made for every episode, and that's all thanks to Christina Naru of smartupvisuals.com. You can check out show notes, transcripts, and our upcoming Secret Leaders live events on secretleaders.com. If you haven't yet, hit subscribe on whatever media player you use. Just follow us at Secret Leaders on Instagram or at Secret Leaders 1 on Twitter. And tell just one friend about how frickin' awesome this episode is. If you want to go the extra mile, I'm at Dan Murray Serta on Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. And we'd love to see you take some screenshots of the episode you're listening to and share it across your social media. It'll bring a tear to our eye and joy to our hearts. See you next week. Tune in or you'll miss out.